Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to our viewing audience across the pond. I am your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you're new to the channel, thank you so much for joining us. If you are a returning subscriber, hey, welcome back on this lovely Saturday afternoon. It will be Saturday afternoon when you see this episode. I am pre-recording this episode for me Monday morning. So sadly, we will not be able to respond to your questions or comments on the screen. I may be lurking in the chat on Saturday morning if I don't attempt to sleep in a little bit. All of us here at TIR would like to send a big thank you to all the subscribers on all platforms and patrons. Without you, we couldn't do this. For those that don't know, this is the Saturday free show. There is no bonus champagne room. It's our way of allowing you guys to get a glimpse of what goes on beyond the velvet rope of the TIR VIP. As I said earlier, this show has been pre-recorded, as scheduling with our guest is difficult because he himself has a very successful podcast and a life outside of podcasting. And since he's written this piece, he's been making the rounds on shows as well. So I was very happy to get penciled in to the very busy schedule of Alex Hockley, eulogizing the millennial left. There has been a lot of eulogizing of the millennial left as a generation of missed opportunities and co-optation. Vincent Bevins, Chris Catrone, and Anton Yeager have recently written books that attempt to reckon with the young left's crisis of failure. Should we expect more out of the generation born on the heels of the anti-political Generation X? Looking at myself here. Millennials were born into the era of commodification of counterculture and a glorification of baby boomer propaganda. So why wouldn't they believe that protest alone would bring about the revolution? From our guest article in American Affairs Journal, Omelets with Eggshells. I did love that title, by the way. For this generation, it seemed as if the crisis was always arriving too early. We were always unprepared, both in ideas and organization. We didn't know what hit us. No one told us politics was like this. Generation X was the generation that imbibed the failures of the boomers and the new left. It was the generation of the end of history. And so millennials took a world without politics as a given, until this was suddenly thrown into question in the 2010s in the terms of the transmission of ideas derived from experience. A gulf separates us from previous generational waves of activism, from the new left of the 60s, and before that, the old left of the 20s and 30s. No one was there to hold our hand, and yet our failure might turn out to be a consequence of the fact that we were too beholden to the past without even knowing it. Again, that is an excerpt from Omelets and Eggshells, an American Affairs Journal. Wherever you are watching or listening to this, there is a link in the description to the piece, to our very guest, excellent podcast, Alpha Bunga Bunga. Please welcome friend of show, Alex Hockley.
Hello. I didn't really hear the introduction because I was too busy tending to my life. It's very busy. My real life that you claim that I have. I don't know whether it adds, you know, gravitas and weight to what I say. If you say, you know, he has this like life outside of podcasting, or no, his whole life is podcasting. I don't know.
I think you have a life. I mean, unless every picture on your Instagram is just all staged.
Isn't it all?
There's a crew of people. There's a fake woman that you throw out there to pretend she likes you. Unless all that's fake.
Yeah,
I think you have a life. I'm somewhat envious of it. I look at those pictures sometimes. I'm like, man, fuck that guy. I'm bald. Why can't I have a life like this?
This too is open to you, bald man. You too can have this. Follow my three simple steps.
No. I'm joking about being. I'm very happy for you, actually. Getting to know you from when we first had you on from the End of History book, which I have to send a shout out to Gene Bajlan, who suggested that to me when he was still. I think Zero was done at that time, but it was in that weird transition phase where I don't think Sublation had like got off the ground yet. I think your stuff got through before the Doug Lane exodus. I'm really glad I got to read it. I've read it multiple times. I've suggested it to people. I think I've even bought it for a few people. Very important book. Maybe your book kicks this off. Coincidentally, I don't think, you know, you got, unless you guys are all a clique and this was a plan beforehand. You and Jaeger and Bevins, and that would be funny. But I think it is a very important read in this pantheon of leftist eulogies, and yours might be the proto eulogy. So again, thank you for joining us. Is it too soon to write off the millennial left? Didn't the same thing happen to Gen Xers?
I mean, part of the problem with answering that question is that it itself is somewhat question begging, right? Okay. Because then you go, well, what is the millennial left exactly? Mm-hmm. Why are you defining it in generational terms, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is a question that other people have asked me about in my article. I mean, I take the term from some of the books that I've reviewed, mm-hmm. and I don't think we even used the term specifically in the end of history. Mm-hmm. But this is all part of a bigger discussion and an ongoing kind of critique. We've had, I think, all the authors almost on the podcast before and have had them on, you know, over the past 5 years or something. So it's a part of an ongoing, an ongoing process, an ongoing discussion and critique of the millennial left. And whether you use the term millennial left or not, I'm not wedded to that. But I think what is important and what binds the millennial left as a coherent concept, whether we use that term or not, is the fact that it refers to the wave of activism that followed and responded to the consequences of the global financial crisis of 2008. Mm-hmm. So we on BungaCast did this big series on generations, right? Looking at the emergence of generational consciousness back in the mid-19th century through to the early 20th century, and then looking at the boomers, Gen X, millennials, Gen Z, etc. Right. And one of our main points that we made in that, and it's something that I just taking the opportunity to repeat here, is that generations, you know, it doesn't really make sense to talk about generations as a coherent category across society, but there are certain moments that are so formative that they do create a sense of generational consciousness. Right. Yeah. And certainly the baby boom was a massive one because it was the first generation that had grown into the affluent world post World War II. Of the welfare state and so on, where people had access to consumer goods on a kind of mass scale for the first time. And also the fact, just the very material fact, that there was a genuine baby boom. It was a very big generation. So there was a lot of young people looking around being like, hey, we're all young here. Now we're different to these old guys who knew the world before the war. So that's a real thing. And millennials, a little bit less so. I think for millennials, the real formative moment, although it's a sizable generation, and it depends, you know, what country you're talking about. But in the U.S., millennials are bigger than Gen X. I don't think what determines the millennials is the size of the generation in the way that the millennials, that the baby boomers were. Yeah. What's definitive for the millennial left is the global financial crisis. And that actually means that for a lot of people of the millennial generation, myself included, you know, some people belong and some people don't. Right. If you came into adulthood and were already like in the job market and were maybe 25 when the global financial crisis hits, your experience is very different to someone who's 15 when the global financial crisis hits. Right. And these people, the 25-year-old in 2008 and the 15-year-old, are bundled in together. Anyway, I'll say all that as kind of a bit of a prelude. But the real point here is that the global financial crisis is the first moment of the end of history, of the falling apart of the world of the long 90s, of the post-Cold War era, where everything was taken for granted. There was consensus around liberal democracy as the final form of human government, et cetera, et cetera. And the global financial crisis throws that all into question, brings in very severe austerity measures, accelerates neoliberalism, especially in Europe, but in the US as well. And so this whole experience provokes a wave of activism, certainly from Occupy onwards, and then, and for that matter, the Arab Spring as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to kind of look at it specifically in those terms. And if you look at it in those terms, then the answer now in 2024, 4 years on for the defeat of Corbyn and Sanders, you have to say, well, that moment's gone. So you might say, well, millennials, you know, I'm a millennial. Maybe I will be involved in future waves of activism that happen in 5 years from now and will be very involved and whatever. That doesn't mean that it's the millennial left moment. Use whatever term you want, but it is like it's clearly one can bracket that period from 2008 to 2020 as like a coherent sort of moment unified by responses to the consequences of the global financial crisis. And now we're in a different moment. And whatever happens now, whatever if there's a sudden upsurge in activism, that would be of a different moment. And that's that. So I think in that regard, we can say, yeah, we can call time on this.
In your article, which is a brilliant analysis of the three books, If We Burn, Death of the Millennial Left. I haven't read Yeager's book yet. That just came out, right?
Yeah, I think they all came out in 2023, like towards the end of the year, I think.
Yeah.
I got my review copy, I think, back then. But I mean, you know, it's also ideas which he has written about and together with his co-author, Arthur Borriello, written about in various other places. So it's and in any case, as I say, it's all part of a kind of a discussion that we've all been having, I think.
Oh, definitely. And we've had Yeager on to talk about his articles. And I really like Anton, actually. The post 2008 crash, you have these three phases that you talk about of the millennial left. You just said the post 2008 crash and the election of Obama, the anti-capitalist protests, and finally the young left's flirtation or fixation on achieving political power. The first part for me is interesting. I like to do more domestic look at the domestic left for me, the U.S. left, and the election of Obama for a lot of people, much like the election of Clinton, is an end to 8 years of Republican rule and also a foray into war that lasted for 20 years. And Obama was supposed to be an end to that. He was the first black president. To many people, he was, I don't know if you remember, he was a socialist. Remember, a lot of people called him a socialist. Far from it, right? The Obama years is an interesting time because it's also a lot of people's first time getting political, millennials and Gen Xers as well. And that organization to get him elected definitely falls apart after he gets into office. Can you speak about these three moments for us? And let's maybe start off with the post 2008 crash and why that's such a pivotal point for this look at the millennial left.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when, you know, before writing the review essay, I wouldn't have thought of the anti-war protests of the 2000s as belonging to the same moment as the millennial left for the reasons I've just been saying. And I still don't. But I kind of took my lead a little bit from the books and the way that they put those things themselves, particularly Chris Cutrone's, which starts off by talking because his book is made up of contemporaneous essays. So it's all responding to current events, which is different to the other books. The books are looking back. He's looking very much at the moment, and it's a compilation of these essays. So but he talks about the kind of anti-war left of the post, you know, post Iraq invasion period. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 2000. Arguably before 2003, but certainly 2003 up to 2008, that whole moment. But I would categorize that as kind of the millennial left's prehistory. I don't know if it really makes sense. There are always continuities, and I think we maybe get on to the way that there's continuities between these different waves of left activism from the boomers onwards, and how, in a way, that's a problem because, as I write in the article, it turns out that maybe we're too beholden to these ideas from the past, which we haven't even consciously digested, right? It's something that we've just kind of eaten.
I have friends that were part of that organization for that great big protest in 2003, and I was with, I won't say his name, but I was with one of them some months back in the Bay Area where I'm from, and we were talking about that because I've just been trying to pull a perspective out from the people that were there, that were actually there, and kind of get a sense of what they felt at the time and how they feel now, right? Mm. And one thing that this person had said to me was, you know, we didn't have organizational power in labor unions. We had no political power. And, you know, pretty much they just waited for us to go home. Yeah. And once we went home, it was business as usual. And all this didn't mean a thing.
Well, not to mention, of course, the election of Obama, which in the U.S. more than anywhere else is so determined. Like what the left is doing is so determined by who the president is at the moment. Mm. Oof. Like, you know, oh, Obama's here. OK, cool. Let's go home. It's fine now.
Yeah.
Everything's fine now. So, you know, like, but that's why, because you have this long kind of interruption. And certainly Obama's elected on a sort of anti-war ticket. For mm-hmm. all that he actually accelerated the whole the kind of perma war thing, mm-hmm. but he was elected on that, and so he puts an end to that. And so there is a break, you know, that by 2008 the anti-war movement's already running out of steam, yeah. and you know, then the global financial crisis, and it turns everyone's attention to something else, right? And it's and to a certain extent it turns people's attention to capitalism, in quotation mm-hmm. marks, mm-hmm. And that I argue, and some of the other people that I've reviewed also argue, that there's something at least incipiently positive in that, in not just doing this very defensive anti-war argument, which doesn't really carry with it a vision of a world that might be different, but here it really targets the kind of nucleus of the system, at least ostensibly. And so that initiates the real millennial left as we know it, right? Mm-hmm. And that phase is the phase of protest, of the occupation of squares, many times taking their lead from the Arab Spring in particular, mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, Occupy Wall Street. There's the occupation of the squares in Southern Europe, in particularly in Greece and in Spain. So you have this whole process, and you have the student demonstrations in London as well, which I was involved with, and often involved kind of being kettled by the police. So there was a kind of occupation of the streets inadvertently. because we were forced to just stick around for hours and hours in a police kettle. But so I think these were kind of shared experiences, and there was in the UK there were occupations of university departments and things like this. So it was all a reaction to austerity primarily, mm-hmm. and it was all the tactical response to that was occupation, generally speaking. And that occupation often didn't really have a clear end in mind. On its according to its best kind of best case interpretation, you'd say that this would be a way of getting people together in a shared space and to build connections and to build organizations. At its worst, it pretended to be prefigurative, which is to say that whatever we're doing here right now is in some ways already communism, and therefore we can learn from this, or if we just keep doing this thing, then communism will happen, or whatever. Probably don't even call it communism. They'd call it, I don't know what they were interested in. But
anarchism, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly.
Would you say, as someone that was in these protest spaces before the Sanders Corbyn moment, because I'm a true believer that the Sanders Corbyn moment is kind of where socialism, communism, these words become more comfortable to say. Identities start to get built around these ideologies.
Yeah.
But we're also coming out of the 80s and 90s, and if you were, I don't know, leftist wasn't even really a term people used. I don't even, alternative counterculture person. Liberal was still kind of a good word in some circles. You were anti-consumerism. And do you think what we saw in 2008 was kind of an extension of this anti-consumerism?
I think that's partly right. Yeah. I mean, I remember, I mean, I studied anti-consumerism back in the, well, but sort of in the 2006, 7, 8 period. I remember, you know, kind of when I was at university writing a thesis on that. And that was a piece with a certain like anti-modernist left, which mm-hmm. tried to reject the superficial aspects of corporate life in the name of, well, it's unclear what it was in the name of. It was sort of based on an imagined idea that one could do without industry, do without a lot of the superficial aspects of consumerism. But it was really premised on an idea that everyone has enough. Everyone's kind of fine. You know, their lives are fine. So if we just consumed less, we would have a more authentic way of living. Right. So I think it's interesting because that's very of a piece with the pre-crisis moment when the economy is not politicized, when people's living standards are really not. It's like, well, there's economic growth. We don't really care about that. We're kind of against it, but probably don't even think about it because economic growth is something that happens on in the background. Capitalism works even according to its own terms. And so what we need is to try to carve out a more authentic way of living within this. So what if we just got rid of Walmart, where all those poor, horrible, poor people shop?
Yeah.
Yuck. Yeah. Ew, right? So there was a different snobbery to that anti-consumerism, but not that disguised, I think. But that all changes again. That all changes after the global financial crisis, Occupy and all that kind of stuff that comes after the occupations. That is a moment of responds to the global financial crisis and the question of austerity, but it also tries to respond to the crisis of democracy and the lack of representation. But its answer to that question is anti-political. So broadly speaking, it rejects the political establishment without really proposing anything new in its place. There are no big banners that are waved that it say, hey, we want socialism, or we want, I mean, at best, it was calls for direct democracy. I think that was probably the extent of it. But broadly speaking, it was a rejection of those politicians there who don't represent us, who don't have our interests at heart. And, you know, if they were gotten rid of, maybe something good happens, right? Or maybe we just need to get rid of democratic politics as a whole and just have some more direct form of representation. At its furthest extreme, it's precisely that horizontalist notion that we all here encamped together are the new government, that we can kind of rule directly over this little space. And then you have the farcical reenactment. I mean, it was already kind of farcical, right? Mm-hmm. It was already farcical, but then you have a farcical reenactment of that during the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, of 2020. Where you have the occupation in Seattle and stuff like that. So, that's this bizarre continuity. And I think it's important to mention that. You might say, well, that's a quite specific example. Who cares? I think it's important because it shows that the way that so much of these waves of left activism keep kind of repeating themselves, even when they appear to be the opposite. So even when you've had, so in the more direct scenario is like, well, you have the waves of occupation, then you have the more the kind of Corbyn Sanders moment where you're focused on elections and winning power and it seems far more serious and it's talking about socialism. And then when that all falls apart, it's like, well, let's back to the anarchism, you know, back to the anarchism wagon. Let's go do the thing that we were doing before. But as I'm sure we'll come on to discuss in a second, what's fascinating is that this second wave of millennial left activism, the Corbyn Sanders moment, retains a lot of continuities with the first moment, even though in many ways, it pretends to be its opposite, right? So even though the first wave is like leaderless, it tries to be horizontal. It says we're all here kind of collectively together. We just need to occupy this square and then the regime will fall, right? Mm-hmm. At least, you know, that was what was going on in Egypt, but to a certain extent in Spain. The second wave then says, no, actually, we need leaders. We need to focus on elections. We need to talk about power. You know, we can't just be in the square and make our demands and be the good guys against the bad guys and then good things will happen. No, we need to be much more practical. We need to be much more engaged with power. But then what's ironic is that they have these bizarre sorts of continuity between the leaderlessness and the leaderist focus, despite them seeming opposite to one another. And I mean, one of the objectives of the article, or I guess the main one that I want to bring out is to kind of learn the lessons from this, because we don't want to find ourselves in, you know, 5 years time with suddenly another upsurge of activism amongst the masses as a whole. And not just the educated middle class, because in most cases we're talking about kind of educated middle class, albeit downwardly mobile, being the main agents of these protests and of the political parties and the kind of Corbyn Sanders moment. But if there's another upsurge, so we don't just repeat what we did before, thinking like, well, now it'll be right this time.
But you know, you and I know it's one of the further questions down the list. But you speak about the leaderism. I've definitely done some work on that. There's a video essay we have called We Don't Need Another Hero, where I somewhat jokingly talk about the love affair with daytime talk show hosts and how it seems funny, but we have to remember that Donald Trump became president of the United States. Right? Jesse Ventura became a governor, and Arnold Schwarzenegger became a governor. So we do have a love affair in this country. Ronald Reagan was a president with celebrity culture and its ability to kind of wrangle the masses. And in the 80s and 90s, sure you might not know, U.S. pop culture to this extent. And if you did, I'd be shocked if you remembered Morton Downey Jr.
Nope.
That's okay. Okay, good. Because if you knew that, I was going to walk myself and say, turn the TV off. but he was a pretty far right figure. But before we kind of have, I don't want to say an understanding, but images based on these ideologies, where people can actually say, I am brand right winger, I'm brand leftist. Morton Downey was just brand loudmouth, but he was to the right of people like Rand Paul in the 80s and had an extremely reactionary show, but it resonated with young people, and his audience would be filled with young people that wanted to see him pretty much yell at leftists, which I found kind of interesting. And there is something to be said about this moment where everybody wants a hero, and there does seem to be a feeling of doom and gloom as 2024 looms near, and there's this election coming up in the States, and no one knows who to vote for. Well, I don't want Biden, I don't want Trump. You know, it's like, well, it's never been the only thing you could do. There was a world where we organized around other shit.
In fact, it's probably better that there is no one to get behind,
that
my focus minds on
But it feels like the focus on institutions or organizations isn't even there. I mean, DSA is losing members. So what's happening with this idea of leftist organizations even?
So I think one of the most positive, and I'm not in no way do I want to oversell this, but I think one of the positive elements, it seemed, of the period, let's say the populist period, because let's just for the sake of terminology, there's the protest period, which runs up till around 2014 or something like that, and then you have the populist period, which is 2015 to 2020. And so the populist period is now turned towards organization, at least ostensibly. It's turned to elections, turns to leaders, it turns to kind of in some way trying to get people all together in a more formal structure. And it's by no, it's not by chance that at least two of the books, and indeed in our book as well, talks about the question of organization. And it's not like, it's very important, I think, not to reduce the question of organization to just a tactical question. So like, how do we organize better? Like, what do we do? And I think across a lot of the left, there's often a very regular confusion of tactics and strategy, and indeed of those two, and goals, which are not the same thing at all. So when you talk about organization, I don't mean like, we needed to knock on doors in a different way, or change our messaging, or we needed to, get people form smaller groups or larger groups or whatever. That's not, those are kind of very much tertiary kind of questions or tactical ones. The question about organization is fundamentally an ideological one. It's about how you conceive of politics. And so you might have an insurrectionary conception of politics, where suddenly the masses who kind of break past their instinctive conservatism and turn out on the streets, and then that can lead, either they be led by a small group, vanguard group, or somehow just all collectively seek to overturn the powers that be and storm the Winter Palace or whatever, but that implies certain organizational questions about what you should be doing, right? Whether are you going to form that vanguard group to lead the people once they all turn out on the streets? I mean, that's a legitimate answer. I'm not sure it's the right one, but it's a legitimate answer, right? Which follows on from your conception of politics. Or maybe it isn't. Maybe it's slow building with that capillarity, which is, I think, is a word that's not really used in English. It's maybe in Portuguese, so I get that confused. But, you know, basically from the grassroots up, that you have, you know, hierarchical and linked organizations, and that capacity, which is built from kind of the local level of civic organizations through the political party all the way to the top, and that you build this political block, and little by little it gains ever greater power, getting, you know, winning 5% at the election, and then 10%, and then 15%, and trying to break through to get a majority, or at least a plurality in an election. You know, and then that entails other organizational strategies and tactics, right? Mm-hmm. What I think is like the real problem with this whole period of the millennial left is that these questions are at best broached in a purely tactical manner, and that they skip steps, right? So the problems of organization, particularly the ones that Vincent Bevins talks about in his book on the kind of global protest movements, I think is like, it's fairly obvious, because I think most people already agree with what the problems are there. The idea that you just occupy a square or the streets and you shout slogans and good things ensue, when we know that that can be very easily co-opted and at worst ends up in civil war. But, you know, in a less bad scenario, it just ends up disappearing and evaporating with nothing having happened. Or it's co-opted by the right in different ways and used to their benefit. I think everybody knows that that's like bad, right? It's like, we shouldn't do that.
I don't ever underestimate. Don't ever.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, if you're listening to this and you think it's good, it's not. It's bad. Okay. It doesn't work. It's actually disastrous. And it leads, and it, you have to speak for yourself and say what you're about. And the fact that all these occupations and protests rarely had a real name for themselves, and certainly didn't have a name for what they were for, I think tells you all that you need to know. If you don't speak for yourself, someone else is going to speak for you. And that's what ends up happening. You have the international media speaking for you, framing it as a, you know, kind of color revolution style pro-democracy uprising that suits kind of U.S. imperial interests. Or you'll have more organized and more ready to use violence right-wing groups who are able to seize the moment, or just simply large corporations, the media, etc., who will be able to turn it towards their own interests. So that's very bad. But so let me just get to the point about protest. What you think the protest movement, or excuse me, when the populist movement resolves about that, is by having a more focus on organization. But as I point out in the essay, there's like some ironies here. So what happens is, like, with these small with some small nuclei who organize these, end up kind of inadvertently organizing or calling these mass protests, or these protests which grow to be very big, is that because they don't have any formal organizational structure, it ends up relying on informal friendships, right? So it ends up being you and your mates calling the shots, and there's no accountability there, much less accountability than a formal organization where people are elected to leadership positions and you can recall them, hold them to account, and so on. And that applies at the very small, like, nuclear level, as well as in much larger organizations. And the irony is that the populist turn on the left from the 2015s onwards is that a lot of the political parties, and you can look at various examples in Europe, tend to replicate that, because instead of having a formally organized party with branches, with branch leaders, with cadres being formed, with having a chain of responsibility leading up to the top, what you've got is this whole mass of new members who've often joined for nothing. Maybe they haven't even had to pay dues, or they've joined for very little and therefore can leave without any real consequence, and often have joined via online platforms. So you get this big mass of people, and Arthur Borriello and Anton Yeager's book is very good in explaining this dynamic. You have this mass of people, and then you have this leader at the top, and maybe you have a small number of other people who support the leader. But what happens is that this is ostensibly very democratic, because you have this big mass of people who can vote on what policies they want to be pursued or whatever. But there isn't really the space for deliberation to happen. And so it's not really the membership creating policy in the traditional way that political parties used to work, but rather a big mass of people often just ratifying what the leader has decided to do. And what ends up happening is that you end up with a fairly unaccountable clique of people at the top calling the shots about how the party should act, what its policy should be, what its general approach should be, what its politics should be. So the populist movement thinks it's avoiding and circumventing or resolving the problem of organization of the horizontal moment of the protests and the occupations. What it actually does is, in many ways, it replicates it, because it doesn't really grapple with the deep organizational problem, which is the lack of density of civil associations, which form the building block of parties, and always did. And so, like, you know, that's one of the many ways in which the populist movement tries to skip steps politically, I think. And we can maybe talk about some of the other ways, but ultimately it's based on a kind of quick shot at power, right? Like, let's just grab what we have here, try to cobble something together and make a quick shot at gaining executive power. And we find that that doesn't work. And even when it does work, it tends to fall apart pretty quickly.
Well, were you living in Brazil during that?
So I was living from 2016 onwards. Yeah.
Oh, so you were there.
So I was here for the, yeah. And caught the tail end of what had been a mass mobilization of the left, but not even necessarily subconsciously of the left, but which made social demands, social and democratic demands. So it was at least incipiently like left wing or left oriented. And that burst out in 2013. It was the biggest protest movement ever in Brazil's history. 2 million people across the streets over months, and which continued into the World Cup the following year, and protests around the building of these mega stadia and whatever. And then by 2015, 2016, that is explicitly right wing, like, turned against the Workers' Party, and ends up leading to the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. So I was there for the kind of second act of that, the second or third act. Yeah.
You get there for the kind of the right wing turn, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I'd been following it from abroad, but of course, when you're actually here and you see it on the streets and you feel it in the atmosphere, then it's an entirely different thing.
What's interesting, so we had Vincent Bevins on the show, and I have to thank you for that, because I had emailed him, never got back. You sent the homie bat signal out, and I got
the bunga signal. It's
like, I appreciate that. That's what friends are for. And he had, you know, again, I don't know how many books Vincent sold with the Jakarta method, but I felt like more people really loved the Jakarta method more than If We Burn. And I really hope If We Burn sells a gajillion copies, because it's a very important book, as is the Jakarta method. But there is no secret underlying CIA co-optation with a lot of these. And there's so many people that want to, you know, there's a government deep state spook operation pulling the strings. A lot of this is just kind of pointing the finger at maybe a failed strategy. Is that hard for people to swallow?
I mean, so my immediate instinctive answer is a kind of psychological one. And I know that's probably wrong, or you shouldn't do that. But there is people who decide that they're on the left, I think in many ways are motivated by a sense of injustice. And that's pretty fundamental. And it's like, you have this idea that you have people in power and they're bad in some way.
Yeah.
Whether that's structural, or whether in the worst case scenario is in a very fetishistic way understood as being them somehow, you know, constitutionally somehow bad or evil, and therefore against your interest, but whatever, in one way or the other, you know, the world is run by people who are bad or doing bad things. And there's just a wave of injustice, and we want to fight the good fight. And I think there's a kind of always a temptation towards being the glorious loser, which I think is not a good kind of disposition for politics. And people on the right, to a certain extent, have this a little bit, you know, because there's the kind of lost causers, from the, you know, people who wave the Confederate flag all the way through to kind of contemporary Trumpers, or various forms of kind of, you know, right populists or national populists, who also like to play victim, because unfortunately victim politics is now entirely cross spectrum. Everyone
That's a whole show, brother.
That is a whole show. That is a whole show. But it's important here, because I think the left does have this, you know, the left kind of started it, I have to say, of wanting to be the victim, because they want to speak for the victim, but also be the victim. And there are any number of tragedies. And Vincent's book about the massacre of a million people in Indonesia, and the way that that kind of completely destroyed any prospect of revolution. And indeed, even of reform in Indonesia, something we covered on our podcast quite recently, again, is something which is like obviously very effective, but also, you know, but also writes the left kind of out of the story, right? It ultimately, there's nothing really you can do about that other than scream about injustice. But, you know, there's no one to appeal to. There is no one in charge. There's no daddy or ombudsman or judge or whoever to whom to appeal to say, this was wrong, we want restitution. There is no one. And sometimes maybe we forget that and therefore are too happy to be screaming about injustice rather than actually trying to think, okay, well, the critique should be turned at the left. There's no point really critiquing the right. They're not going to be unlikely to be very swayed by moral arguments. So we need to be critiquing ourselves. We should be unstinting and pretty brutal in our critique of ourselves and what we do in a way as a way to seek to do better, which is a bit of a trite way to put it, but as a way to kind of rethink our politics and in terms of effectiveness and then think of like, what do we actually want and how do we get there?
I mean, look, what you're talking about is even hard for people to do on a personal level, right? There's a billion-dollar industry on, you know, not looking at yourself in the mirror, but, you know, having better words to call other people names, to not look at yourself in the mirror and say, maybe I'm the problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, it's a difficult thing to do. And I think these books that we're talking about do an amazing job of it. You know, I'll put a link to all the books on this show so you guys can check them out for yourselves. I've read, well, again, I haven't read Yeager's book yet. But because of our relationship with Sublation and Ethnogatrones, and again, I loved Bevan's book. Usually for these shows, we read, or I do, read as much of the book as possible before the guest gets on, and then I have to move on to another book because we have so many guests. But that's one I went back and finished and then read the conclusion again, you know, highlighted a bunch of it. Very, very important book. Shifting gears a little bit. One place it seems the millennial left has had some success is in the media. Nowhere as large as the multinational corporations that run media conglomerates in the West, but much more successful than underground zines. Is this a good thing? What happens to a left that has its most successful base in online spaces and not organizations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, one to which I don't really have a direct answer. Obviously, you know, given the choice between having a base in the media and having various media outlets, autonomous ones, as well as having representatives being picked up on mainstream media talk shows, that versus having trade unions, political parties, various group of schools organizing and getting together in real life, you would definitely choose the latter. Right. I think that should be fairly, that you'd hope that should be self-evident. I think a lot of the left has often felt, certainly in the period of the past 40, 50 years, if only we had a megaphone, then we could win. Right. So if only we could get these people off of watching Fox News or even, I don't know what all the news channels you have, CBS News, MSNBC, whatever. If we could be on there and just be shouting at people through there, then they would know, right? But instead, they're brainwashed by the mainstream media. I mean, that's a very Gen X style of politics, which the millennial left has slightly left behind. And in fact, the way that the millennial left overcame that Gen X, that bad Gen X politics of perceiving everyone as brainwashed, as everyone a dupe, sheeple out there, who, if only they listened to the right people in the media, then things would be better. The way that was overcome, ironically, was by the millennials becoming enamored with new media and thinking, aha, now we have this, you know, at worst polycentric, but in practice, very sort of autonomous media landscape with all these little things sprouting up. I can get on Facebook and talk to the world directly. I can organize a protest on there. I don't have to rely anymore on getting the BBC or CNN to report on my protest and making it go massive. Now it's in our hands. And so the left fell in love with media again because of the internet.
Did it fall in love with media or did it fall in love with itself? Because there's something very narcissistic I'm
just looking at myself on the screen here. I'm not even looking at you, man. I'm just looking at myself.
As two dudes that make a living, you know, looking at themselves and other people on a screen, realistically, is there something somewhat narcissistic about this moment where everyone has the megaphone? Meet spaces are dead because we can do it all online. This has been said over and over again, and people go, well, that's not really. It's like, yeah, it's still kind of happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the. Do you remember the cover of Time magazine in 2012, 2013, Person of the Year? And the Person of the Year was just like a mirrored cover. So as if to say, you're the Person of the Year. And I'm like, oh, fucking awesome.
Seriously, I was thinking about this as I was reading your piece, and I remembered a conversation I had with Doug Lane a year or so ago, where we were talking about the Truman Show. And I'm like, are we all in the Truman Show now? Because it does feel like that moment. I had Joshua Citronella. I probably said his name wrong. Citrellia. Josh, if I said your name wrong, Josh, you have permission to punch me in the nuts. I'm sorry. But he wrote a very interesting piece on these kind of crazy political ideologies he found online. We joke about it with this image right here. This Calhoun Leninism.
That's like MAGA communism, isn't it?
Yeah. Kind of like the MAGA communism thing. There's all these kind of odd ideologies that don't make sense. And you can do that in this current medium.
But I think that points to the fact that, you know, this would have been a critique that would have been directed pretty much to the left, and maybe not, you know, people might go, well, no, but not the various kind of socialist little groups, but broadly speaking, the kind of cultural left as a whole, right? So we were talking about people in the media, academia, everybody kind of progressive, all sort of progressive across the side. It would be directed at that, primarily at that sort of group. The thing is that now this is across society. This is, you know, as I talked before about the way that victim politics has become completely cross spectrum. Well, the kind of media narcissism also is now cross spectrum. It's no longer an issue which you say, well, this is something problematic on the left. So I think that to a certain extent means that we have to change our critique of it and how we approach it. But yeah, I mean, you know, you put it back to me like maybe we didn't fall in love with media again. We fell in love with ourselves. And I think there's a lot of truth to that insofar as we saw ourselves reflected much more directly in a way that we didn't see ourselves reflected in CNN back in 1990 or whatever, right?
I mean, look at the Sanders moment for a second. Those cats that were part of this, not everybody, but a lot of people that were in that campaign, that party, were working for Sanders. Sirota writes a script that I think was Oscar nominated. Breonna Joy Gray's got a podcast. Nina Turner had a podcast. Like, a lot of those people went into media. They didn't go back and work on other campaigns. Again, I'm only speaking domestically. I can't speak for the people that work for Corbyn.
But there was a similar process that happened in Britain. I think to pick a really farcical example, Pablo Iglesias, who was the leader of Podemos, the kind of left populist party in Spain, which emerged from the streets, from those occupations that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And then academics got together and formed an actual political party, which you think, oh, that's good. That's progress. That's way better than just occupying a square. Occupying the square has actually led to some real concrete politics of a political party. And then they got into bed with the kind of mainstream neoliberal center-left party, and that killed any kind of radical credentials they had. They got identified as being at the same time too establishment and too leftist, which mm-hmm. I think is interesting. And then, you know, now it's kind of all kind of gone. I mean, you know, it still exists, but and now I took the piss out of this on Twitter the other day, but you know, Pablo Iglesias is now setting up a bar in Madrid, and you know, okay, that's fine. Nothing against that. I would love to have my own bar in Madrid. I mean, Madrid's great. Love the bar, blah 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 blah. But the thing is, it's all lefty branded. So all the drinks and the cocktails are all have like you know, Fidel Castro or Leon Trotsky or whatever it might be
named about that.
And it's just so kitsch that I'm like, I just find it very cringe. So anyway, I kind of feel like that's itself a kind of its own coda on the millennial left. But, you know, to talk about media, I think that it is the positive way to look at it, I think, if it were this, and I don't think it is, it's that this is a moment of very deep political crisis. And I think the backwash of the wave of millennial left activism should allow us to be actually asking really deep questions about what politics is and can be or should be at a very fundamental level. I think we might have to go way back, right? Kind of forget everything about the 20th century, go all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century, maybe. Ooh. Because I think our position historically might be more analogous to that than it is, you know, before the formation of the working classes, of the proletariat, and its emergence in the mid 19th century. Maybe we're in a position more comparable to the 1830s or something like that. And I say all that because I think we have to be serious about considering at least the possibility that we might need to rethink everything from scratch and try to avoid, therefore, these little shortcuts to kind of like, oh, let's just pick things up where we left off in the 1970s, pretend neoliberalism never happened, and just roll back neoliberalism. As if neoliberalism was just some bad ideas which bad people came in and implemented and they were more powerful and we can stop them and we could just reverse it, which is not the case. The neoliberalism was fundamentally a crisis of the whole post-war order, which couldn't continue because the system runs on profits and profits were squeezed then. And so for the system to run, they had to do something else. Neoliberalism worked. Neoliberalism worked for the system. It worked. It was necessary for it. There was no other solution. The solution was revolution.
Would you say it worked again for people in the 90s during the Clinton years to the early 2000s?
I think to a certain extent, because it finds also neoliberalism is able to remedy its legitimation problems, not so much its accumulation problems, right? So it's not about not so much the profitability question, but about how much trust the regime has. It was able to resolve that by adopting kind of more lefty ideas. So you had the original neoliberalism of Thatcher and Reagan, which was nasty and horrible and right wing. And which may be sold to certain people if they were yuppies and aspirational, but for other people, not. But the Clinton-Blair moment, and even up through to the Obama, and indeed what Hillary Clinton was trying to sell, was one which said, well, look, you get under this regime, you get gender equality, you get racial equality, all the old prejudices and bigotry and whatever is being left in the past. Of course, they have to keep saying no, but actually it's a big threat because you need to keep buying into it. But at the same time, the sell is that, well, you don't want to go back to the old racist and sexist 1970s. What you've got now is you've got a real win here. You're more free now than you were before. You can consume your freedom.
We were consuming our freedom in the 90s and early 2000s. Financial deregulation in the United States, and I'm not saying this is a great thing. I'm just explaining the moment due to financial deregulation starting about 94, really, right? The end of Glass-Steagall. A lot of people are lifted temporarily. The word doing the heavy lifting is temporarily out of poor and working class into middle class and from middle class to,
there's loads of private credit sloshing around the system.
Oh God, yeah.
And a load of cheap commodities coming over from China. So, you know, a TV, which would have been an expensive thing to buy, suddenly, like, it's one of, if you look at kind of commodities whose prices like really dropped over the past 20 years, TVs have become suddenly really cheap. You can have loads of TVs, right? And you can have and you have credit to buy that. And so that buys a certain amount of legitimacy, right? And so it worked for a while. I don't know where we were with media in relation to that, but I think
you can watch us on your smart TV.
Anyway, I know where I was going with that. To kind of loop back, my point is that insofar as media provides a venue for reflection, discussion, debate, which you guys do very well on This Is Revolution, we try to do it on BungaCast, I think that's good, right? And I think that's important, especially right now, because it just simply going out and acting and I think is, as we've seen, as I write in my essay, as these books testify to, hasn't been productive. We've ended up in many ways in a worse situation than we were in 2012 or something. So So I think in that regard, it's good. On the other hand, and what is probably more realistic, is that a lot of the kind of mediatization and media focus of the left is a way probably of avoiding these discussions. And for a lot of people, for individuals, just to kind of have a sustainable kind of life and have some public profile and whatever, which, whatever, good for them. But, you know, that's not, I think it's
not what we started this for, right?
Exactly.
None of us started this so we could get recognized, you know, at the local coffee shop. You say in your piece that the millennial left has become the last defender of neoliberalism. Now, that definitely resonated with me because I've been working on something I wrote, kind of a long essay that Alfie turned into a little mini book for his everyday analysis. And my follow-up to that is called Come As You Are, Neoliberal Leftism. So when you said that line, I was like, God damn, man, I really like Alex. What did you mean by that?
Okay, so I think we can understand that in three different registers. The first is that it is neoliberal insofar as its politics are parasitic on what neoliberalism promises as its benefits. So I've already mentioned particularly kind of the politics of race, gender, and sexuality, which are fundamentally neoliberal, and the left's job mainly has seen the left has seen itself as or seen its own job as being making good on these promises, right? And saying, ah, no, but you all are sexist, racist, blah 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 blah. We need to kind of make, you know, we're going to be the real anti-racist, anti-sexist, blah 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 blah. Mm-hmm. In that regard, it just kind of kind of perpetuates the neoliberal politics, precisely because a lot of this politics is basically the politics of human resources. It's the politics of the professional class, and it ultimately is, if anything, it builds organizations and capacities for the policing of the working class more than anything else. The second way in which it's neoliberal is that it just reflects back a lot of the other general tendencies of contemporary capitalism, which I wouldn't reduce necessarily to neoliberalism, because neoliberalism could be overcome tomorrow and these features would probably still persist. And so I cite some of them in the essay. Short-termism, right, which is, yes, a product of financialization and product of fast-moving financial flows. Everything needs to be today, instant, just in time. The left kind of reflected that in its short-termism. Let's get Bernie elected now, and then who cares what happens next? Bernie will have won. Yay.
But is
like,
it?
Oh, hang on. Okay.
Does that speak to the moment that we're in, where everything is just in time? Like, we can only see the world in just in time.
I mean, yes, but you'd hope that the left was able to somehow bring values, perspectives, principles which don't currently exist, and speak in their name, rather than just reflecting back what's going on now. So, I mean, yes, it's hard, right? But I think the short-termism thing, I think, is really important, because if things remain short-termist, we are doomed. Forget about it. Give up. Take care of your family. Enjoy doing. Give up on politics.
go to retreat.
Give up on politics.
I want to ask you a serious question about that. So I went back to the Bay Area to do some family business, and I had to meet someone that's going to come on the show soon, and they wanted me to meet them at this protest in San Francisco for Palestine. And it was probably about 15 people in front of the San Francisco Chronicle building. And of the 15 people, 10 had to be in their 70s and 80s. Are we a little disconnected with the old left?
Yeah, I mean, they would have been the new left.
It would have been the new left.
The old new left, yeah. Yes, I mean.
And is that a good or bad thing? Because there's different. Let me add this. There's also different new leftists that I've had on the show that I've met in real life. You have the SDS faction, and you have the people that were like anti-SDS. They're like, well, those are the rich kids.
Right.
You know, yeah. So you have.
Which, yeah.
You definitely have different flavors.
I think, you know, on one level, it was problematic. And, you know, you go to any left meeting, it was always like a couple of old fellas and then a bunch of millennials and then hardly anyone in between, which to a certain extent, bolsters the case for talking about this in generational terms. I know, even though people, myself included, are allergic to kind of generational politics. I'm against generational. I'm against millennials versus boomers. That's bullshit. Yes. That's utter bullshit. But in terms of categorizing and understanding things as waves, then I think there's some use to that. But anyway, I think that, so in that regard, the kind of breaking of traditions is problematic, because it means that you feel like you're constantly reinventing the wheel and you're doing dumb stuff, which maybe your elders would have experienced before. On the other hand, and here I'm very much with Chris Cutrone and his interpretation, which is that the problems of the left, what we have inherited as the ideas of the left today, are basically an inheritance of defeat. It's the defeat of the 1930s, it's the defeat of the 1960s, it's the defeat of the 1980s, and now the defeat of the 2010s. And we've taken those ideas for granted as being like, yeah, that's good leftism, that's how stuff works, that's what the politics that we should have, when in fact, it's those very ideas are ideas of defeat. They're ideas that led to defeat, and they're ideas that are products of past defeat, right? So, resistance against neoliberalism. Well, that sucked. That didn't work, did it? And yet we kind of think like that's what we need to kind of do, but do better and do in a different way, but continue doing that. We need to have kind of spontaneity and self-expression, be able to like be yourself. Well, no, that's just the dumb bullshit 1960s ideas, which also led nowhere and led to actually, in fact, a cultural revolution within capitalism, which provided the very basis for neoliberalism. So there's all these ways in which we have swallowed this stuff and not digested it and not really thought about it. So in that regard, you know, the temptation would be to say, let's forget all the histories of the left from the 1920s onwards. Let's forget all that, right? But unfortunately, if we just forget, we'll just be doomed to repeat it. So I think there needs to be some form of digesting and continuing critique of ideas of the new left, ideas of the Gen X left, and indeed now ideas of the millennial left. It needs to be continually critiqued in the name of what we fundamentally want. Right. Not just can we go back to like 1963, which incidentally, the whole political spectrum wants to go back to 1961 or whatever in some guise or another. The left wants to go back to kind of social democracy and the welfare state, maybe jobs of that period. And the right wants to go back to a more kind of monocultural society, maybe it has racist conceptions of a kind of more racially exclusionary society without migrants and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But you know, that's what everybody kind of wants to go back to, and I think we have to be conscious about the fact that there's no going back, and think about what truly we want. What does liberation, human emancipation, look like today? That's what I mean about really going back to the start of things. So I think the question of tradition, which I raised here as a problem, is a tricky one. You know, I don't have there's no kind of five-word answer, kind of snappy.
No, look, brother, I didn't bring you on here to tell me the answers, right?
No, I'm good. I don't have any. Leave me alone.
that's why we have these discussions. I wish you were there with me. I think we would have had a fun discussion post that thing. But it was interesting to see people still, quote unquote, fighting the good fight. At these advanced ages, go ahead, what are you gonna say?
I think they're not being short-termist. And by the way, when I say, you know, we can't be short-termist, that doesn't mean you can't fight against injustices and wrongs and fight for freedom in the here and now, in small things, local things, whatever. That's not at all what I'm saying, right? So lest I be misunderstood, the point about short-termism is that capitalism, you know, I mean, is in some ways in decline. The growth engine has disappeared. It's becoming increasingly authoritarian. Things are, there's hardly anything very positive that one can point to, bar advances perhaps in medical technologies. But, you know, but broadly speaking, this is not a moment of world historical progress in any sense, even in the kind of one-sided sense that capitalism always is. In that, and the rulers of capitalism, everybody who's in charge of anything is just thinking in very immediate short term, not looking to resolve the issues. They're looking to the next election. They're looking to the next quarterly earnings reporting, et cetera, et cetera. And so if the only people it falls to that to actually think long termism is those on the left, those who are committed to human emancipation. And so that you need to be thinking in 20, 50 years time spans and work backwards from there, rather than necessarily just be, you know, kind of,
but it goes back to the whole next thing. But to me, it goes back to the whole short-termism. And even if you try to talk, it's hard to talk about in generation terms. People say, well, they said the same thing about the 80s and they said the same thing about the 60s. Like, yeah, I get that. But we're in a moment now where anything I want, I can get from a job. I could just turn on an app and work a little bit. My neighbor in the front drives Lyft in San Diego a couple days a week. And can pay his rent. Again, I live in Mexico. It's, the cost of living is a lot cheaper. Get a date. We were joking on the show the other day about from gig economies to gig relationships. That has to affect the way people see the political spectrum as well. Because you're doing something that didn't happen before. Is you have a voice in a small box that seems like a large box. So what I mean by that is you can say, I stand with Palestine, and 1,000 people write on you. That feels like a lot. But in the grand scheme of things, Netanyahu gives no fucks about your Twitter post. It's not moving the political needle. There is no left to move the political needle anywhere. In that, but it does feel like politics. How do you get out of that is my question, because it feels so fucking permanent.
I mean, it's the same, or at least to make a comparison, it's like the same sort of dopamine hit that you get when you post some nice picture on Instagram and people, you know, give you a little heart. Right. And I think avoiding that, but I thank you for saying the point about, you know, driving Lyft. And cause I think that, you know, it's a very material reality, which the question of, you know, having everything instantly on hand, whether you want to order something as a consumer or indeed you want to provide a service as a producer, whether you drive Lyft or you do deliveries or whatever else you might do as a sort of within the gig economy or platform economy. That's a very material reality, which expresses itself in consciousness insofar as people think in very short term ways and feel very insecure and unstable in their lives, which then itself has material consequences, right? So I think it's, you know, these aren't just like, it's not like we can just be materialist and not think of ideas. No, these things are very intimately connected. And I think you illustrated that really well, actually, with making that point. So where was I? I think I just wanted to round out about the point about being neoliberal, actually, right? Because you asked me, like, how is the left the last standard bearer of neoliberalism? So I made the point about the politics of race, gender, sexuality. Right. Mm-hmm. I made the point about short-termism, and there's other elements in which it reflects back the biases of the contemporary order, which is the bias against political programs, against mass organization, against institutional building, the reliance on media and charismatic leaders. All these things the left kind of has just reflected back what the mainstream and the right is doing. And then there's a final way, which is that it's just wedded to organizations which are neoliberal or neoliberalized in various ways. So the left in Europe is broadly speaking wedded to the European Union, to the process of European integration. It believes it can reform something that is fundamentally unreformable and is designed not to be reformed. It bakes in economic policies. It's like an economic constitution you can't change. You know how hard it is to change the US Constitution? Well, the European Union is basically like that, but actually far worse. You know, the US Constitution is way better. At least it gives you freedom of speech. That's really important. The European Union locks in policies in a very, in a much tighter sort of way. So it's wedded to the EU. It's wedded to organizations like the Democratic Party, which it believes it can't really kind of see beyond. It's wedded to the university, which has been fully neoliberalized. And to the extent that it ever kind of provided a little kind of safe haven for creating ideas or whatever, it very much does not anymore. And, you know, there's other people who can speak much better to the kind of crisis within academia than I. But the point is that it's the left is either hunkered down in these institutions and the media as well, for that matter, and therefore won't really want to go against them, or is just wedded to the notion that, well, you know, the Democratic Party is the way somehow to pursue, you know, pursue your end goals. And I think at some point rupture is necessary. And I think the problem with the millennial left, one of the kind of four major problems I highlight, is that question of rupture and an unwillingness to really make rupture, even when it's handed to you on a plate. So I talk a lot, and I've talked a lot about on BungaCast, but about the examples of Brexit in the UK and Syriza literally being in power, literally in charge of government, and having 61% of the Greek people say we don't want to accept this memorandum, and therefore implicitly we need to leave the European Union. Well, we need to reject it, which would most likely mean leaving the Eurozone and leaving the European Union, and then backing away from it, backing away from a massive democratic mandate because they couldn't broach rupture. Because they didn't want to lead, and ultimately that is a moment where leadership is essential. So,
I think that's a real problem. You know, you've talked to Giannis, right?
I haven't. No, I should get him on the podcast. But I think like my co-host Phil has said such nasty things about him. It'd be difficult to get him on the podcast.
But I'm not gonna act like he just knew who the fuck I was. Pascal and I had a contract with the Real News, and we had so many people to interview for the Real News, and he was one of them, and Pascal had asked that question, I think, in closing of our interview, and he's still hurt by it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, by that decision. It was the death knell for him, and you write about it in your piece that trying to have some sort of foresight to say, if we don't do this, it's going to be bad, but it's going to be bad regardless.
Yeah. It's going to be difficult. Like, and you know, Chris Coudron cites Trotsky in his book, and I think it's completely right about, those who want guarantees in advance should give up being a revolutionary. Now, of course, the answer to that might be, well, we never wanted revolution. What are you talking about? We just wanted kind of a return to social democracy, to roll back neoliberalism. As I said, I think that's rather impossible because of all of the conjunctural factors that made the post-war order possible are no longer there, let alone the fact that there's many aspects of it which would be undesirable. It was a product. It was a product of defeat. It was the kind of grand compromise that emerged when revolution didn't happen across the West. So I think the point I would underline, I guess, is that there's no guarantees, and there's a whole discourse which is used very instrumentally to diffuse any left-wing radicalism, which is to use victimhood and to say, well, if you do these things, it's going to break up a lot of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. If you leave the EU, if you try to break with the Democratic Party and run against the Democratic Party or do whatever might happen, then bad things will happen. Trump will be elected, or there'll be a massive recession or whatever, and this will hurt the poorest and most marginalized who you're supposed to be caring about. How dare you? Shame on you. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's just a bullet you have to bite. That's kind of propaganda on behalf of the status quo, effectively, and doesn't reckon with the fact, again, being long-termist, things are getting bad and they're getting worse. So that image of how bad things are going to be if, Trump gets elected or you leave the European Union or whatever, those are going to happen anyway. It's just about, one, what timescale it happens over, and two, whether you actually have some horizon of possibility that is created through your actions. Whereas if you just stay put and try not to break too many eggs, right, to refer to the title of the thing, if you stay put and don't try to break too many eggs, you're going to get, a shit omelet regardless, but there's going to be no possibility of moving beyond the current order. So you have to be willing to break eggs, right? You're not going to get that omelet without breaking eggs.
I don't think we're willing to break eggs.
But maybe not now, right? I think the only, the optimistic vision, and I think, Benjamin Studebaker writes about this. I've talked to him on the podcast a couple of times, and his book, I think, is another one of these you can add to the pile as referring to the kind of current moment and to the millennial left and whatever, is that we might need to kind of reach the bottom of the barrel, the bottom of the well, and to really be despondent and have very little hope left in any of the current institutions that exist, to really start thinking seriously and clearly about what would be necessary for political change.
I did hear a little bit of that Studebaker interview, and I really liked it. I heard the little trailer you guys put out, and I really dug that. So I need to pick up. Is his book out yet?
His book is out. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It came out last year. I think we had him on the pod. That episode's free now, I think. It was the one we did the interview on his book. But I think it's a very good book. I think it's very thought-provoking, at the least.
I like I said, I really like that conversation you guys had, from what I heard. and I see the sun is setting on you, so I'll let the sun set on this conversation.
It shouldn't be. It's just that it's monsoon rains which have come in, and so it's like prematurely dark. But yeah.
Well, I it's a holiday here.
I'm not saying like no, keep me on, don't let me go.
I'm sure. Again, I've seen your Instagram. I'm sure there's wonderful things you have planned today. You're gonna play tennis with your shirt off or some shit like that, you son of a bitch.
Well, that sounds way better than.
There's no research you have to do or reading. You're just gonna go galloping.
I was gonna go for a jog tonight. You know, if it's not raining,
just gallivant.
Yeah, gallivant. I should do far more gallivanting than I do. Thank you for the encouragement.
As we head into the 2024 elections in the West, there's like elections here in Mexico as well. What role, if any, is the millennial revolutionary left going to play at all? Does it feel to you that a lot of people are going to sit out this one?
Yeah.
The UK as well.
So the UK is going to have an election. You know, Labour is going to win by a landslide of some magnitude, unclear exactly how much. And, you know, in the US, I suspect Trump's going to win, but it'll be tightly fought. There's not going to be any even kind of progressive, let alone really radical presence, I think, in these moments. You know, and across Europe, if you're looking at, there's going to be European elections for a parliament, which is effectively a rubber stamp parliament, but nevertheless acts as some sort of a bellwether. It's going to be the same usual kind of right-wing populist and indeed far-right parties who are the beneficiaries of that, who generally benefit from a protest vote, but which when it comes to time to national elections, they rarely are able to really put together a resounding win. And I think one interesting thing that the past couple of years has shown, particularly in Europe, but I think in the US with Trump as well, is that for all their putative and rhetorical radicalism, these right populist parties just become part of the establishment. And all they do is kind of reform the establishment kind of rightwards and change the discourse on certain cultural issues, on policies like immigration, and relitigate the past in many cases. So, hey, actually, Mussolini and the fascists, maybe they were kind of all right. You know, maybe they did some good things too. I mean, that's what Maloney's
maybe
doing.
Maybe he just went a little too far.
Maybe, exactly. Yeah. Someone just needed to rein him in a little bit. But, you know, but this is something that happened with Bolsonaro in Brazil, trying to say, hey, the military dictatorship was a time when things worked, when it was, when, you know, there was economic growth, when there was order, there was, you could have a stable family where there was public morality, blah, 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 blah. Milei in Argentina,
segregation.
Right. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. The way that the components of the rainbow coalition of the Democrats is falling apart, and indeed many parts of it moving and voting increasingly for the right, I think is a very interesting phenomenon in the U.S. And I think it's happening to a certain extent in Europe as well. Which again, at least hopefully, should provoke people to think a little bit more. A little bit more deeply, rather than just relying on the idea that demography is destiny. But you know, I think the left isn't going to do anything now in 2024 in response to anything, or indeed probably by the 2025 elections in France. Wait, have I got that wrong? I have got that wrong. But anyway, just trying to think of other kind of major elections across the West. But you know, the left isn't going to have anything to say to that. What we can see is the fact that any sort of anti-establishment, anti-political force and drive that, and indeed frisson of excitement that these right populists provided, I think will eventually kind of fade away because they come into power and don't really do anything. You know, Meloni is more Atlanticist than even, you know, than her predecessors in Italy. Le Pen has shelved any kind of discussion of really of breaking from the European Union. So for all that there's talk of this radicalism and they're going to bring in fascism or whatever, no, they're not even going to.
What about Milei? What about, is it, am I saying it right? Milei in
Argentina. Argentina. I mean, you know, there it's a disaster. The inflation has increased, which he promised. And there's a lot of resistance. You know, there's a lot of kind of resistance in the streets from trade unions as well to his policies. So I suspect he only lasts another year or something before he's chucked out. And, you know, all these kind of right populists have different vibes to them. You know, Trump is a little bit more left wing. Maybe I'm being provocative there. But, you know, he was anti-globalist in a more serious way, at least in trying to repeal a lot of the free trade agreements. trying to perhaps even challenging the preeminence of NATO and saying, well, you European countries pay for your own defense. So there was something a little bit kind of, you know, radical there, which played to kind of Rust Belt voters, whereas other ones are just fully kind of libertarian stroke neoliberal, you know, which is the case of Orban in Hungary or Wilders in the Netherlands, or Milei, who's to take the furthest extreme in Argentina. And so they're even less interesting, I think, in many ways. But I guess the only interesting thing is how they're able to challenge or channel a sort of oppositional vibe against an establishment which is perceived as quote-unquote socialist because it is bureaucratic. And unfortunately, I think in the minds of a lot of people, socialism is almost coterminous with kind of bureaucracy and people telling you what you can and can't do, which I think is lamentable, but is the case and should prompt us to think a little bit about what our politics are and should be.
That's why I love getting into political conversations with strangers.
Yeah.
I'm always shocked at what strangers just want to. I don't walk around with like hammers and sickles on my shirts at all, dude. So I don't know why people want to yell at me about politics all the time. But Alex, you got some changes coming up in the BunkaCast. You've added some people, I think, from what I saw. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we go?
Yes, we've had a revamp. We've been going for 7 years. Maybe got that famous 7 year itch, you know. But we're not splitting up. We're just getting bigger and better, I hope. We are partnered now with Damage Magazine, so subscribers of the podcast get a free digital subscription to Damage, and I think Damage is excellent. I'm part of the editorial group there, as is George.
I published something in Damage, so
yeah. Fuck yeah, no, it's definitely a great magazine. And so we're going to have regular Damage authors and editors on the podcast to discuss their articles and go a little bit deeper in that. Damage is actually looking forward to publishing its second issue, which should be out soon. I'm very excited about that. I have a big long essay in that about our hyper accelerated world and how to.
Ben Fong has tasked me with writing something that has been the biggest. Maybe because he tasked me with it, that it's been the biggest hurdle.
Yeah.
About steroids and a bunch of other stuff, but it's been really hard for me to flesh out. But I saw you had a Catherine Liu and
we had a Catherine Liu, Amber Lee Frost, yeah. Lee Phillips, and Alex Gurevich. So all people who come from different kind of disciplinary perspectives. That's putting it too academically, but you know, kind of have different interests, different areas of expertise, different focus. But who I think collectively will be coming on the podcast kind of on a monthly basis each, and we'll kind of contribute to the conversation and hopefully able to we'll aim to do more and also broaden our coverage to areas which we maybe sometimes neglect. So more culture, more questions of psychology and of affect, more kind of questions of literature and arts, but also more on science, technology, the built environment, climate change, and things like that. So a lot more stuff, and I'm looking forward to, we're just kind of getting started now on a revamp. So I hope people will join us.
Well, wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there are definitely links to the Alpha Bunga Bunga podcast, one that I listen to more than watch. Listen to it on Podbean, where I distribute my shows as well. There's also a link to the article in the American Affairs Journal, Omelets with Eggshells. Did I say it right?
That's it. Omelets with eggshells. Yeah.
He is Alex Hockley.
I'm not Hockley.
I like Hockley makes you sound like you're a smart guy from a foreign land.
Hockley.
That's how I'm supposed to say it.
Which is how I was supposed to say it, but I don't even say it that way. So you know.
Fuck. Okay. Yeah. I can't go around saying that all wrong. I'm still trying to pronounce it. Spanish words, right, bro?
Do whatever you like. It's fine. The labels are secondary, you know, including names.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with me. Please tell George I said what's up. I got the pleasure. I was very, very honored to be invited to be a guest on your show last year. So
we'll have to do that again. It is, as always, brilliant to talk to you, as it has been this time. So I look forward to more of it.
It's always fun. Thank you guys for watching, And we are out.